Well, not in this case. You're not going to troll on in, but you're going to take a long ride on the boat, and then you're going to get to a place where you can find what we call the deep seven. Ah, those little squiggly bottom fish. You know, we talk about that a lot. A lot of you have seen boats that say that BF on them. That means they're a bottom fisherman. And there's a lot of people involved in this fishery. It's, you know, the fish that we mostly talk about are the onaga, opakapaka, gindai, kalikali, and all of these things that are delicious. Well, there, it's not a bottomless pit, and yet it is also not a heaven we've caught them all. As a matter of fact, I want to tell you about a very special project that's been underway. It actually started in December of last year, and it is called the Hawaii Bottomfish Oral History Project. You've heard us talk about it a little bit before. This is a joint project done under the auspices of NOAA. As you know, Uncle NOAA's got a group called the Pacific Island Fishery Science Center. And they, along with other stakeholders, like my friend Clay Tom with PIFG, they work in collaboration to produce a report. And that's what we're going to talk a little bit about today. Kind of a long introduction. It's a way to introduce you to our panel. Kirsten Leong is a social scientist with NOAA at the Pacific Island Fishery Science Center. Kurt Kawamoto is a fish biologist, also with them, and they're doing this thing. So to be polite and proper, we're going to say first to Kirsten, hi, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How long have you been involved in this milieu? What, you know, this being a social scientist?
I've been a social scientist for natural resource management for about, almost a dozen years now.
Did you think in the very beginning that you were going to get all involved with fish doing this?
I did not.
I don't think so, right?
No, in fact, I first started out working with deer, but I moved over here to Hawaii and started working with this team, and it's been great, yeah.
Yeah, and everybody says, you're a local girl, right?
Come through a few generations here. Yeah.
But pretty interesting. And let's make sure that we understand that this project is a true collaboration, right? I mean, it's not, is it being driven? Is there an agenda? What was this study commissioned for? What's it all about?
It's really to get a history from the fishermen's perspective of what their experiences have been over the years, fishing for bottom fish, learning about the traditions, things that are important to them, the stories that they have, so that we can look at that together and really understand better the evolution of the fishery over time.
You know, when I first got involved with the council through sponsorship of our program, and we heard about this being a bottoms-up, you know, group, and that we're doing something in collaboration with being able to help. Fishermen were not as ready to impart some of this wisdom as they seem to be now. So isn't that part of the big challenge? Why do you want to talk to me about my bottom fish, and how's it going to be used against me?
That is always a discussion, but I think a big piece of the success with this project is our partners. Mm-hmm. And it's really because of their connections with the fishermen, and really making sure that the way that we're asking questions is not asking people to give up any secrets. It's to ask for sort of their impressions.
Really important. That's what we're going to talk to our fish our biologists about in a minute. But Clay Tom, who I've known for a long time with PIFG, the Pacific Island Fisheries Group, this is an example where you guys are going to go out and talk to your peers and say, you know what, we got to cooperate with these guys because it's for our joint good. Is that true in this instance?
Yes, definitely, Mike. And I think it's for us to share and document our history in the bottom fish fishery and, the cultural, traditional part of the fishery.
There's some great stories, huh?
Awesome.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And so that means, let's find out, Kurt Kawamoto is a fish biologist. And with this particular study, I think it's sort of interesting, Kurt, because first of all, what is a fish biologist?
Well, for my job, I'm in fisheries monitoring. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I've been down at the fish auction for, I don't know, 20-something years now.
Yeah.
And I've seen it come and go and all the guys coming in. That's why I'm really interested in this project. I've met a lot of the bottom fish guys, and I've been the one who's been calling around Oahu. Mm-hmm. If you've gotten a weird phone call saying, my name is Kurt Kawamoto, and I want to talk to you about bottom fish.
What I think is interesting about that, Kurt, is this. We were just talking before we get on the air. A lot of us, you know, who aren't bottom fishermen but do bottom fish, we rely on science. And I'm not sure that up until within the last decade that it's been as valuable as it is today. I mean, how much of this is... Forget about fish stocks and assessments. We can talk about that at another time. But when you first found out about this particular project, why did you get behind it? Why do you think it's valuable?
I thought it was really valuable because, you know, our history in bottom fishing, it goes way back.
Yeah.
And it's one of the few things that the local small boat guys can do. it's not like, you know, having a big charter boat or anything like that. This is, you know, mom and pop, my neighbor next door can all get out there and do bottom fishing. Doesn't cost as much as the other stuff. It's more economical, high valued fish that you can catch.
You just have to have a strong stomach. If you're going to be out in the rough water, you got to have a, kind of a strong tummy.
And but very culturally significant.
But that being said, let's talk about the, first of all, what is the magic of these magnificent, I mean, these deep seven? There's something about a bottom fish, ground fish or ground, whatever you call it. There's something about the texture. There's something about the meat. There's something about them that make them probably more desirable than a pelagic. Why is that?
Well, for the people who like to eat, you know, the white meat sashimi, these are the premium stuff. It's the onaga and the opakapaka. You know, you can eat them either raw or cooked. I mean, there's so many uses for them, you know, besides soup and everything. And the cultural side of, you know, giving a redfish to somebody who's sick or something like that.
Yeah, and so that, you know, I can remember that. If you had an onaga on your table at New Year's, you somebody, especially if it's a big one, right? That's the thing. But in fact is, from what I understand, that these fish maybe don't have the same concerns that some of the pelagics do with, say, mercury and, say, some of the other things. Why is that?
Well, it depends on, you know,
the mercury issue. Shouldn't say it's not without a problem, because we all have problems. Yeah. But it seems that we don't, there are certain of the bottom fish that are like cigatera, right? That they get a little hotter than others, like, you know, kahala, for instance,
yes,
right?
Yes, kahala.
Yeah. They're not out of the woods, are they?
No, as far as I know, we haven't done any studies recently, so I don't know where the state of the kahala ciguatera problem is.
Yeah, but Clay, you and I can remember when it used to be in the market all the time. People used to buy that fish up.
Yeah,
now we're now everybody's scared of it.
Right, exactly. And that's why the beauty of bottom fish is that they haven't been really implicated in that. And, you know, it's great. But to get to the fish, that's the important part. And the guys who do it are the fishermen. That's where the rubber meets the road. And these guys are important to our fishery, and not only fishery, but also for those who are not able to go on and catch fish. These guys are, and they're specialists at doing it. It's more of a, you know.
I know one thing. There's certain guys that are bottom fishermen that I can count on. Right. You know, like our mutual buddy, Roy Morioka. If he's going fishing and I want to buy some of his onaga, I know, or opakapaka, I know where it's going to be. And there are some of us that are trollers that we have no clue what we're going to catch. But you guys that are fish bottom more, you pretty much are species specific. You know where your fish that you want is.
Correct, They have the ability to target.
Yeah.
And that's important.
Okay, so with that being said, let's go back, Kirsten, to some of these interviews that started back in December. The compilation of what do you want from the guys that you interview? What set of questions? What do you bring them?
We have some pretty open-ended questions to just kind of walk through their history with the fishery, starting with how they got into fishing, their kind of memories of the most important things to them about being involved in the fishery, sort of through present times, and then thinking to the future in terms of what does the future hold? What are some of the trends that people are seeing? Yeah. So again, looking at their personal experiences, their personal stories, and how that all kind of fits together.
You know, and on the other side of that, when we get to you, Kurt, because of your time spent at the auction, I'm sure now that you're such a fixture, they're going to tell you, hey, I go where I used to go, no more fish. I have to go here now. I have to go there now. But yet, from what I do understand, that there are also many others that are level and honest. And they know they go there, there is going to be their fish there because they, not that many people fish it, or because it's a very, very productive ground.
Yeah, that's true. There's fishermen who have been fishing the same grounds, or they rotate their grounds such that, you know, they maintain the fish population in that area.
What I thought was interesting about that is, let's say that you do that and I do that, but my grounds and your grounds are kind of the same. We don't discuss them, but we know we're kind of the same. So you leave alone hole B, but I'm over at hole B and I'm still catching fish. So, you know, is there a time when some of these interviews will actually overlap and you can make some sense out of that?
I'm sure they will, because you said, you know, everybody doesn't fish the same area at the same time. Yeah. And we all give our areas a rest every so often. And that doesn't preclude anybody else from fishing there. But, you know, we know that we're not taking X number of pounds out of that area.
Yeah. But you know what I think is interesting? So most of the fish we're talking about are in a specific depth. You know, I mean, and that depth may be on the banks, or it may be on the edge of the banks. But before you get off into, like, no bottom water, it seems to me that our bottom fishing areas are limited.
Yes, they are kind of limited. And it changes every year depending on the currents that bring the food to the fish. So every year the fish move from place to place. So they're not in the same places every year. There's some spots that seem to be very productive, and a lot of them have been closed with the bonefish restricted areas.
Yeah, and that's another thing. That's another thing, Clay. We've talked about that before. And I know that there's a lot of wisdom in these closures, but there's also a lot of pushback by guys saying, wait a minute, you want to close that area, but that's where I fish, and there's plenty of fish there. Why do you want to close an area that is so productive?
Right, and I think it for the self-managing bona fishermen, like Kurt had mentioned, that when you start to rotate areas, now these areas you rotate are taken off your and you know they are permanently rested. Yeah. It puts more pressure on certain areas, and I think there's some impact to that.
Well, aren't there a lot of guys that they say they're a bottom fisherman, but they're really not? I mean, they might bottom fish 2-3 times a year, but those that are consistently out there, they're the ones that we must be interviewing. They're the ones that we must be talking to. How helpful has it been to have PIFG's seal of approval on these big bad guys from NOAA doing their interviews?
Well, I think, you know, when you mentioned that on the trust level, I think it's we look beyond just the relationship with the agency, but more of a collaborative effort in terms of perpetuating our bottom fish heritage and fishery. Yeah. And as you know, it's a lot of generational knowledge. And that's what we're trying to talk about, because a lot of it doesn't get passed on unless you learn from somebody else. And that's what we're finding out through interviews. It's been very interesting.
You know, has there been, and I'll ask all three of you this, and you can just all respond. Has there been pushback, or not pushback, but guys that say, hey, look, you know what? Before the GPS and all this stuff, we never had to worry because nobody could find where to fish. And now, you guys, it's so easy. You catch fish over there, you mark it, you go back next year, get some more. Is there some resentment about technology?
There might be, as far as for the individual fishermen, it's great because, like you said, we can go back and hit the same spots. So we, all of us, have a whole load of spots all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
But there's other fishermen who might, you know, take advantage of that, where you know, you're fishing here and the guy comes along and he pushes
just I was gonna say, wait a minute,
and he just steals your spot, kind of.
When a guy, you think a guy is waving at you, he's just putting up next, puts a button right there, that's the guy's
grab. Yeah, I know. Yeah. And you go back next week and he's right there, or you know, fishing your areas.
That's why I was saying, Kirsten, when I asked you earlier, that having somebody come up and be able to cooperate and volunteer this information, there must have been a tremendous amount of build up of trust, because this is all about trust, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and this is a project that I think Clay was telling me earlier about, how the history of folks talking about wanting to do this project and how to pull it together. And that didn't come from NOAA.
Yeah.
It came from outside of NOAA. So we're just facilitating, helping to kind of organize the way that it's all brought together. But it's really the stories of the fishermen, and they're really the ones that were driving it. Now, there are definitely some things that we're really interested in terms of looking at, like cultural importance.
Sure.
And
like the onaga on the table at Christmas time. Got to have it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of that is what's called anecdotal right now. But this is one way to kind of systematically look for those stories and look for the similarities and be able to say, here's the evidence that these are the culturally significant fish. And we don't have a list of that right
now. Yeah, I think, though, and Kurt, you probably know this, the word gets out very quickly. There are some guys that they don't have to take their onaga to the auction because they got guys, especially times these, I don't care how big it is, I just want one.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And that's part of it. But what I'm also trying to get some sort of a feeling about is that, you know, the research that you're doing has a beginning and an end. Right now, it started, the interview started in December. They're going to go on for a couple of more months. At the end of that, what's it going to be used for?
Well, I think Kirsten can answer that better than I could, but what I'm looking for is, you know, an oral history with the visuals of the actual fishermen. Because it's nice to put a face to all these stories.
Yeah.
And the voices, and that's what's really going to make it come alive. And
I know one
for
good
the
picture,
future generations.
One picture you're talking about is, I remember when Ed Ebisui was on the cover of Hawaii Fishing News years ago with that monster onaga on it, right? They thought everybody catches these. But that's a good thing, Kirsten, because obviously the decisions being made about catching and areas and size and all of that stuff needs this stuff. I want to talk a little bit about the questioning that has to do with the gear, because I know some guys that are commercial bottom fishermen that have electronic gear, they have good gear, they go to their puka, they get their fish. And I know guys that are bottom fishing that use a basket full of ahu and a hand line. How much does that come into what you're doing, the gear?
The gear, I mean, we ask people about innovations in gear. We ask them about the kinds of things that they do, but it's we don't, you know, anything, if they're not comfortable answering a question, they don't have to. So it's not that we're making them answer specific things about gear types or anything like that, but it is something that comes into play. And we've heard some really interesting stories about sort of evolution in gear and technology and how that's changed the way that people have fished.
Well, you know, kids can go out, and Kurt, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, we should talk specifically about it. Kids are going to go out and play baseball after school. They just need a mitt, a bat, and a glove, and they're off playing baseball. People that don't bring the right stuff when they go out bottom fishing, they're not going to catch a lot of fish.
No. You know?
So have we seen a dramatic change in the gear?
Yes, we have. Yeah. Everything is not hand pulled anymore. Yeah. It's not by sight landmarks on the land and everything. Now it's all electronics. And, you know, if your battery goes down, you're dead in the water.
You know, I used to have this one place, Clay, out by what's now, I guess, the one of the buoys off Hawaii Kai, where it used to be, you line up this place on the top of Cocoa Head with the pine tree and all of this stuff, and it worked. And you know, you could tell when somebody was near your place, so you'd go far away not to share that. But now, like he's talking about just the gear itself, the fishing gear, it seems that we're going to deplete the fishery quicker with that gear than we could with the old gear. A lot of people say that.
A lot of people believe that, but basically when you look at it, it's still a hook and line. It's a simple fishery. Yeah. There's no trapping. There's no netting. Yeah. There's no trawling. It's a basic hand line gear. And that was from ancient time. Mm-hmm. And what else? Although technology has changed, what hasn't changed is, again, we hop on the knowledge. What current, what moon, when the fish will bite, all that comes into play. And a lot of people do not understand that, but these successful bottom fishermen that we talk to do. And I think that's important to realize that you can't just take your line and you have your GPS and throw it on the spot and you're going to catch. It's not an automatic thing.
I know one guy, and I don't know if this has ever come up, but I'm sure it does. Sometimes during these interviews, I know some guys, one guy in particular that comes to mind, my friend, his name is Jesse, that he's a bottom fisherman, and every now and again he'll go to one of his places and the fish will be small. He'll say, yeah, we go, it's too small. In other words, they don't want them. It's not that every bottom fisherman is going to fill every hook with a piece of fish and bring it all in and keep it. There's even, from what I understand, a way, Kurt, to let them back, to put them back. They come up small, you know, there's a way you can put them back down gently, you know, so they don't blow up, huh?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we have different release methods, and PIFG has been at the forefront on some of them, and it's called a release weight. All we do is we put a weight on the fish, and we send it back down, and it just automatically releases at the bottom. So you take them down through to all the pressure zones.
Yeah, and rehab them.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they're gone, right? Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, though, and once again, I go back to Kirsten, the social scientists in you must realize that once this stuff is all compiled, and there is agreement, and people say, wow, I'm so glad to find that Uncle So-and-so felt the same as I do. It looks like we can agree to help these guys determine what levels that we should be taking or what areas we should be fishing. How valuable is that going to be?
Oh, extremely valuable. Yeah, yeah. I think that's the one of the key pieces. I don't know if we would identify necessarily people's names, but we would sort of be able to see trends that almost, you know, a lot of the people in the interviews said certain things that were very similar. Yeah. There might be things that we can then understand. Is this is a different view just held by a few people? So I think having the collective interviews together that's a really important piece of that.
Oh, what set of questions do you determine? I mean, first of all, how many questions are there? If somebody's going to be interviewed has been asked, generally how long does this interview take? Is that hard?
It's generally about an hour or so. We try to gauge it more on the sense of where the conversation is going with the interviewee. It's not like a hard and fast set of questions where it's exactly the same over and over. It's more driven by the stories that the person who's being interviewed is telling.
When you do that, do you determine the what happens to that interview? In other words, you don't just do the interview and then pass it to somebody else and say, you figure it out.
Well, so for the first step, we'll do the interview and we'll excuse me. We'll archive it with the Voices from the Fisheries, which is part of the NOAA Preserve America program. And they were the ones that offered up some of the funding for this with the cooperative research funding. So definitely the first cut will be make sure there's nothing that would be private or anything that we don't want to share. Yeah. Check that with the interview, and then it would get archived there. And then we do have a team that would be looking at it collectively to try to look for those common themes.
Yeah,
so there's a couple steps.
Yeah, and that's pretty important. So so there is there are variables. In other words, it's not the same old boilerplate question for everybody that you interview. it changes.
No, because it's really about the stories and the meanings that are important to the individuals, and we don't know in advance what those are going to be.
Some of these are going to end up at WPCouncil.org down the road. We want you to check this out. Once again, we're talking about the Hawaii Bottomfish Oral History Project. I think, Clay, that, you know, as you know, I have the guys from Wicked Tuna on all the time, and these are guys that... you put a face to the name and the quotas and all of that stuff, and you can sort of relate to that. Isn't the same value here that when somebody goes to a store and buys a paka, if they could see the guy who caught it and you know, what he had to do sitting there on a pretty rough day where most people would be throwing their lunch overboard, you know, this guy's sitting there waiting for the bite. So the visual part is just as important as the recorded, as the oral part.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah. You know, and like you said, it's putting on... a face to a name, and it's important you recognize these guys, and there's not a lot of them out there, and that's why more so with this project is to, you know, capture that and document the information.
Okay, let's make sure that there are people that who are these folks. We care about somebody that's catching bottom fish once a week, once a month, once a year. They're all the same thing, right?
Right.
Yeah. However, you know, going back to your experience, Kurt, at the actual auction. When Clay says there's not that many, it would seem like when you're at an auction, you see plenty of fish. Well, there's plenty. But really, isn't it the guys that are hardy enough to really make a go at that, this is no easy gig. I mean, they're professionals, and there's not a lot of them.
Yes, there's not a lot of them. And, you know, you see the same recurring names every week in and week out, no matter what the weather is.
Yeah.
And, you know, people don't realize how much they have to, you know, go through and give up, you know, every week. All the time.
Well, you know, when you think about going fishing all week and you're just waiting for Friday, so I'm talking about weekend warriors, and you're going, and all of a sudden Saturday morning their seeds are 8 feet, 12 feet, and you know, no, but I got to go. This is the day I go. Some of these guys, you can explain, they don't have the luxury of making that call. This is how they make a living. So if the water's rough, they just got to button up and go out there anyway.
Yes. I'm in that position. I was, for many, many years. That's what we did. Mm-hmm. No matter what, as long as it wasn't a gale warning, we would still go fishing on Saturdays.
And the only reason why they wouldn't in a gale warning is because their insurance is not going to cover them. I know that from my days too. But I think in many respects, Kirsten, I'll go back to you, and without making these guys feel too good, how important is it to have people around that get it? That either have been there and done that, like Kurt or like Clay, and realize that, okay, what we've been doing all of these years, we got to give back, we got to make sure that we all get studied, because if we don't, there's likely to be decisions made that are going to ignore what we know to be better.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the key things with this project is really hearing the voices directly from the people who are on the ground or in the water every day, you know, not the people that are sitting behind the desk making the models. Mm-hmm. We need that information to put into those models, but you can't get it without talking directly to the people involved.
Okay, that be said, let's talk about at the end, eventually in the next couple of months, you will be POW talking with the fishermen and doing the interviews. I want to make sure that, you know, this stuff doesn't end up. I mentioned off the air, I think, about the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they take the studies or they take the priceless artifacts and they put them in some building where there's 10 million things in them.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the value of what this is going to be at the end and how you see it, you know, say, reverberating through the fishing community.
Well, we're already trying to kind of keep track of our progress. We've started a blog post just to even keep people up to date as to where we are in the process or
where
the project.
Where can they see that? At NOAA's website?
And the Pacific Islands Fisheries Center blog.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And so we're going to keep adding to that as we kind of make progress. And as we go through some of the analyses, we want to put together some shorter videos too, or some podcasts and things like that, just to keep people abreast of what we're doing all the way through.
I think it's so cool because I take it for granted that everybody knows about all this technology, Clay. But in fact, in our community, in the fishing community, with the WPCouncil.org, with NOAA, you can get on a computer when you're not feeling so good and enjoy yourself for hours.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's all out there. Huh?
That's true.
Yeah. What about you? You know, when you guys are talking with the different stakeholders, the different fishermen, was there any skepticism? Was there any, you know, pushback about this particular study that you saw, or are people ready for it?
There was some apprehension in terms of,
good word.
You know, I don't want to share this. And it's not about the secrets. It's more about
the process mm-hmm. and the history of the fishery. And as you know, I mean, Hawaii's been from day one, we live off the ocean, and it's been so important that we document it. And yeah. in terms of, like Kristen said it, and Kurt, is that it reflects back on management, because mm-hmm. that's the ultimate user and the ultimate people that it will affect. Yeah. And to be able to understand the fishery is, and like in the case of the fish itself, there's no other better way to manage.
You know, I got to laugh because back at part of the 169th meeting of the council, or 165th or 9th, just recently, one of the things that I learned at the Fishers Forum was, by a couple of the guys from CNMI and other places, they say, oh, wow, you guys got so many regulations, so many rules in so many places. Let's reflect back again on some of these closures that we're concerned about that maybe were hastily closed. Do you think this information, is it going to help to revisit some of this stuff?
I would hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, because in the case that you mentioned about landmarks,
yeah.
I have an area like that out of Hawaii Kai, and my sons who are now, you know, at an age where they yeah. want to fish, and I yeah. want to pass on my lodge, I cannot.
Yeah.
Because those areas are closed. Yeah, I can't take them there mm-hmm. and physically show them, although they'd like my numbers. I don't have numbers. That was back
yeah,
in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
So you got to understand that the impact to not only the fishery, but also the fishermen and the heritage of the project is that when these buffers come into place and these permanent closures, if you don't pass it to the next generation, then you lose it.
But these interviews are not being done to produce that, right? I mean, this is a history that needs to be compiled. I want to say that working with the folks from the Pacific, you know, the Tsunami Museum in Hilo, it was imperative to talk to some of these guys because they were aging out that remembered that. And I don't think, Kurt, that that's the same problem in this because it, but correct me if I'm wrong, are there new bottom fishermen coming up, or are they so skeptical that, oh, this is poho, waste time, you can't go fish, cost too much money for fuel, I'm not going to go?
Well, you're true. It's true that the old guys are aging out in
yeah,
our fishery
yeah.
too, but there are some new guys. Mm-hmm. You know, this fishery is one of, you know, you got to love it.
Yeah.
It's your lifestyle. It's not yeah. like, you know, I want a job, so I'm going to go do this,
you know,
because
what?
I think it's easy.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I've often said, as Clay knows, I've taken thousands of people through the auction over the years. And I can tell you, when you're in the parking lot, there's not a lot of Mercedes and, you know, Aston Martins and Ferraris there. There's bus up trucks. Mm-hmm. But it's the life that these people are. And as long as they can make a living, they're going to still do it.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's why I'm thinking, Kirsten, maybe when we try to put a value on this down the line, it might convince some young people, hey, you know what? That guy sounded terrific. I want to try that because I learned about gear. I learned about this. But in fact, we want to be able to ensure as a bottom fish eater that somebody's going to go out and catch these buggers, right?
Definitely. Yeah. And I think what you just brought up is incredibly important, that it's not just the economics that are behind it. It's part of the giving back to the community, mm-hmm. part of being part of that sort of cultural exchange that seems to be as much a driver of what people are talking about.
I got to tell you something funny. A long time ago, there was a guy out on the North Shore that ran for office. And all of us used to go out and spearfish and go around the neighborhood and give them the neighbor's fish from Uncle So-and-so. Mm-hmm. You can't do that anymore because that's like bribery or payola or something. You know, that's like salting the mines. But that used to be the way many of us did. That's why I asked Kurt and Clay this. I'll ask you the same thing. There are many of us that might be good at, say, I can raise, you know, apple bananas. And I give you apple banana bread that my wife makes. You bring me the oio a fish cake that your wife makes, you know, sure. or that you make. So how much of that, when you talk about the social aspect of it, not dollars and cents, not yeah. supply and demand, but just about the ability to continue doing what you do is bottom fish.
Yeah, and we definitely have heard some yeah. of that. People talking about, it's not a matter of figuring out, you know, now that I have yeah. the catch, what am yeah. I going to do with yeah. it? Am I going to sell it or give it away? It's figuring out, I'm going to go on this trip. Who do I need to give fish for before yeah. I go out? And if I caught that many fish to give away, then I can look at what's left to sell.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing, model. Clay, when we talk about, you know, a guy that's a good bottom fisherman that's not commercial, but maybe he has a really good day and he's got a lot of extra fish, he's going to sell some. He's still a commercial guy, but not at the same rate as, you know what, I'm fishing because uncle's having a party and he needs some fish. He needs some redfish, so I'm going to go catch them.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and when you look at the history of Hawaii, like you mentioned, I think it's all about customary exchange.
Yeah.
And that's a huge part of the fishery. But it's
Somewhat different from what management recognizes, as you said, commercial versus, you know, subsistence.
Hey, I had this one guy, Clay, you love this. He was, we used to call him Squid Eye. This guy was the best. And I'm the lousy. A squid has to come out of the hole and wrap itself around me before I can find the thing. But I love to eat it. So he used to say, you know what? He said, you're the king of Mempachi. Why don't we start trading? And even that in itself is something that we've now been doing for like 40 years. We've moved past the Mempachi and the squid, but we trade other stuff. It's the lifestyle, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so different here than when you compare that to mainland and other areas. Mm-hmm. But throughout the Pacific region, you hear it. It resonates throughout the Pacific.
Okay. So the big bottom line here, and one of the reasons we wanted you to know, and we want you to go to WPCouncil.org. But you can also go and find out at the NOAA website, Pacific Island Fisheries Science Center. These things really sound good, Kirsten, but I need to know. They all cost money. Mm. And all of this stuff, I mean, everybody is well-intended and really wants to do this. But what drives a bus? I mean, you know, what needs to happen at either the legislative or federal level to make sure that these things not only get conceived but get finished and continue? Is that a hard one?
Well, I think the first thing that we need to do is do the analysis and write everything up and make sure that it gets to the council and that the council is considering it as we move forward in the different regulations.
Is it going to be a tool to help decide regulations?
We'll have to see what comes out of the themes, but we're hoping that there will be a lot of information that we can use to help improve the management of fisheries.
Yeah, I kind of think that's kind of what my audience wants to hear, Clay. As you know, I talk to people that listen to the show that don't fish, they don't want to fish. They don't know anybody who fishes, but they like to eat it. And they like to learn a little bit more about it. That's why not only should we talk about the WP Council and the NOAA Pacific Island Fishery Science Center, but just remind people who PIFG is. Who are you guys?
Pacific Islands Fishery Group, nonprofit, 501c3. And we're here to support the community. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's like you said earlier, it's a give back to the community, document our history. Yeah. And for the process of being bottoms up, it's an important link to getting and engaging with our fishing community, because without that, it doesn't get done.
Yeah.
And everybody has that responsibility.
But who would have thought that you or Uncle Roy or any of the guys that you talk about are going to end up going to silly hearings on the big square building instead of going out fishing? This is a responsibility that a lot of you guys have stepped up to, because if you didn't, some rules and regulations and policies would be changed without input.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, when you look back again, like the Bonifish fishery, it's important. It's not so much of an economic importance, but as you said, the cultural and traditional importance of the fishery.
What I want to do, and Kirsten and Kurt, I'll ask you guys first, and I already know that I can always get a hold of Clay. But when this is done, we should get together and say not only what have we achieved here, but what surprises there were and what we've learned out of it, and more importantly, how we're going to continue it. How valuable a tool is it going to be going forward?
Sure, that sounds great.
Sounds like good?
Hey, yeah.
Kurt,
yes.
Kirsten, nice meeting you and nice having you be part of the program today. Kurt, nice seeing you again. And Clay Thomas as well. Okay, remember, if you want to hear something on the show, it's pretty easy. Go to themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. And if you want to learn more, a little bit more about what we've done, you can go to the NOAA website and then go enter Pacific Island Fishery Science Center. You'll find it. And of course, PIFG is pretty easy. And there's always WPCouncil.org. So you stick around. We'll see you next time. Tight lines, sharp hooks, following seas, big bites, all that stuff. See you.